There are a lot of programs out there working to get kids into the garden. The Soil Mates program in Iowa City is going a little bit further, literally bringing a mobile garden to kids. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. This hour, I'll talk with Scott Koepke, Chief Gardener for Soil Mates, a garden education program from New Pioneer Food Co-op in Iowa City. We'll talk about the work he's been doing with community gardens, school gardens, church gardens, and helping out individual gardeners as well. Later in the hour, horticulturist Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension and Laura Jesse of the Iowa State Plant Diagnostic Lab will be here to answer your questions. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. In a few minutes, horticulturist Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension and Laura Jesse of the Iowa State Plant Diagnostic Laboratory will be here to answer your questions. But we're going to start this hour with a conversation about an innovative gardening education program in Iowa City. Scott Koepke is Chief Gardener for Soil Mates from New Pioneer Food Co-op in Iowa City. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Charity. It's great to see you again.
Yeah, thank you for being back on the show. And this program dates back to 1999, but you've been doing gardening education for longer than that. Give me an idea of your background with teaching people about gardens.
Sure. Well, I guess it started for me in the Peace Corps. And so I was in Senegal. This goes back to 85, 86, you know, and after college. And something clicked. I just realized when I was teaching gardening that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. By the way, before we get started, can I give you something?
Oh, sure.
Okay, you get a present. You get red wiggler worms.
Oh, wow.
This might be the first time we've ever...
My own box of worms.
Your own box of worms.
Thank you so much.
And by
much.
The way, I also brought the banana peel that I ate for breakfast because that's their that's their favorite meal.
Right.
So I don't know if this, you know, appropriate, but I thought... And by the way, don't worry. They won't like bolt or anything.
I'm not worried.
But so...
Well, thank you. That's the first time anyone's ever given me worms.
Okay.
Thank
well, I've got plenty
much.
More where that came from if you need it. But so yeah, a gardening curriculum I developed called Soil Mates kind of sat on the shelf for quite a while. And then my sister Ann started teaching first grade at Pierce Elementary in Cedar Rapids. And she invited me to come to her class, and I went there and spent the hour with those kids. And I remember driving home just beaming. Like, I finally found what my ultimate passion is, teaching kids, you know, how to nurture the earth and everything. And so it's a full-time job now, fully funded, like I said, through New Pioneer, which I'm just eternally blessed about. And it's all based on soil first. My message is I try to give these kids sound bites that they can take home. And they all know that one thing that they walk out with is the phrase, food needs to eat first before we can eat food. They need to understand the order of things, soil first, then plants for food and oxygen, and then us. And not just any kind of soil. I'm talking about biologically robust soil, well-balanced soil, you know, all that. So we do a lot of education about soil science. And root systems are huge. A central tenet of my teaching is biodiversity and balance. And then we go through, and believe it or not, I can cram all this into a typical 50-minute class, but, you know, sun, air, water, tools, mapping, seeds, seasons, organics, nutrition, life skills, and all of which is integrated and reinforced into the core curriculum for these teachers. So I'm trying to just complement what they're already doing as a guest, you know, coming in. And it's very interactive. So, you know, we do transplant exercises in the spring and a lot of composting. I actually bring a compost display into the school on a tarp in the class, and we build compost with worms like that.
Right.
And, I got the opportunity this last year to actually get some money set aside for what's called the Seed Money Initiative. So New Pioneer is now sponsoring. We sponsored 6 school gardens last semester, I believe, supported those kids. And so, you know, it's just, and then like I told you before we started too, the other real just rewarding part of this work is coming up, started last year, food waste diversion in school cafeterias for composting.
So you're teaching the kids about what it takes to make robust and healthy soil, and then you've been actually starting programs to help them compost the waste in the school cafeteria.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a... real challenge to actually do the composting on site. That's further down the road. But just getting kids to understand why it's important to divert it from the landfill is a great first step.
And what do you tell them?
Well, like I say, the first thing we talk about is, you know, I ask how many people recycle. Well, most kids now recycle plastic. But I say, do you realize, you know, you can recycle food, that this old food becomes the ingredients for new food as it's decomposing, as the bacteria is eating all this organic matter, it's releasing all the available nutrients for the roots. And they get that as early as preschool. They can understand that we have a choice. We have lots of choices, some of which haven't been so great. And we can hopefully learn from those mistakes. And instead of throwing it in a landfill where it just creates a lot of methane gas and unnecessary heat and, you know, and most of which goes into the landfill, it's just a stunning statistic, can be composted. Well over 50% of what goes to a landfill is compostable. That's stunning. And so I just encourage them to look at this, the green space or a landfill, and just, you know, think of half of that being fertilizer. And I also say, when you're at recess, you know, do the same thing. Stand outside, take a moment at recess to just look around at all your green space that's being mowed, and just think about what could be grown there for food. So
when you start a school garden, of course, there are lots of challenges to having a school garden. One of the chief challenges is that the main gardening season falls outside of the school year. What kinds of things do you plant in the school garden that kids can actually see start to grow during the school year, and things that are really easy for kids to be hands-on with?
That's a great question, because it's a real challenge being in this climate, April through October, for that very reason. So basically, we start off with just spring stuff, early spring greens, you know, radishes, carrots, beans, things that don't need a lot of maintenance necessarily through the summer, because, you know, that you have to have a really extensive volunteer list of parents involved and teachers involved to keep the garden going through the summer, especially this last summer where it was just devastating drought, you know, and if we, you know, if the gardens didn't have drip lines or access to water, that was a real challenge, you know. But, you know, it's a cliche, but education first. I mean, so before a garden project can even start, I have to come in and just explain this is why it's important to do this, to talk about food origins. You know, you'd be surprised, maybe not, but how many people, not just kids but adults, just really don't get the fact that this stuff doesn't just appear magically at the store. It all starts in the soil. And so I do a little exercise in the beginning of the class where I have a volunteer kid sit down in front facing their peers. And I have a cup of soil, and I have a kid, and I have a tomato, and then I have some pasta sauce in a can. And I have it all shuffled out of order, and the first thing we have to do is get it in order. And it takes a while, you know. And so we finally figure out that soil comes first, then the tomato, then the pasta sauce, and then the kid. So just the education foundation is critical before the garden projects can even begin, you know. And then, of course, the implementation involves, like I say, a lot of parental support. And PTAs have been awesome. I have to mention one person who's my primary partner in this is Heather Widmeyer at Farm to School. She and I partner all the time on these. And so I just had to plug her.
Yeah. And this summer, you've actually, if anybody's ever visited downtown Iowa City, of course, there's a pedestrian mall there. And you've been gardening on the Ped Mall this year. Tell me about that garden.
Yeah, that was amazing. The history of that was a few years ago at Children's Day at Arts Fest, I was in a different spot doing my compost demo in a place that didn't have enough sun for a full, you know, vegetable garden. But I had enough sun for some beans. So I sowed some green beans with the kids, but didn't really get permission from Mike Moran at Parks and Rec, which, by the way, I have to say, here's another plug for those guys. Mike and Sherry and all these folks at Parks and Rec have been absolutely amazing. Because finally this year, they had to remove two trees next to the planters at the library. And then Debbie Dunn and Rachel Carlson at the library contacted me and said, hey, we got this space now open for the garden that you've been wanting to do forever. And so we got it composted and prepped. And then on Children's Day, went in there and direct sowed and transplanted all this stuff. And yeah, that's been pretty amazing. Every day I walk around the corner, I just kind of hold my breath thinking, is this the day that someone vandalized it because it's such a high traffic area. But you know what? Charity, there's something about that. There's some respectful aura around it that I can't explain because it's just been the most amazing experience, the engagement with the community. I mean, literally hundreds and hundreds of people a week. I'm talking to all these folks and they're grazing and we're talking about gardening. And see, because, you know, what I do is not just about growing food. It's about building community. You know, we are building community. I have a phrase, building community by building soil. And it's just been never more true than this project downtown.
Can you give me an example of something that you've been able to see a child learn that makes all of this worthwhile for you?
Oh, let me see. I just see so many little light bulbs going on over heads of kids when they're many of whom have never been in a garden before. And you just start seeing connections being made that are so rewarding. Most of the kids love to get outside, first of all. And it, you know, so it's a natural classroom, you know, math, science, life skills, health, whatever. I can bring a teacher, regardless of their discipline, over to the garden and we can make it fit into what they're teaching. And just the fact that you can see the progress of it, you know, and go from seed to plant to, and actually tasting that and tasting this really fresh food right there.
And you probably see kids trying things they've never tried before.
That's a great point. You know, sweet corn and strawberries are an easy sell, okay? It's a little tougher to get them to try broccoli and okra sometimes, you know. But once they try it, like kale is a good example. A lot of kids have never tried kale. And we have this recipe at the farmer fairs that Heather and I do with kale chips. And it's just a very simple recipe. And at one of the farmer fairs recently, they just couldn't get enough of them. And I just was blown away.
That's,
you know,
great.
So, yeah.
And I mentioned the mobile garden. You've been taking this compost around to schools for a long time. Now you're working on a garden that you'll actually be able to take to schools as well. What will that be like?
Oh, that's going to be so exciting. Well, it's not me. I mean, this is something that other people have done in the country, and we're finally getting it going here. But it involves basically just a mobile garden, you know, that's going to be in my pickup truck, either in the pickup or we're still deciding the design because I might actually have a trailer that I'll just haul that can be mobile and I can just park. And then if the school wants, I can just keep it then at the school for a few days or whatever. And then put a hoop house on it so we can do season extension classes.
Nice.
Like at the Ped Mall downtown, I'm going to be doing some late season spinach coming up hopefully this week. Now that the weather is cooling down a little bit, the seed will germinate. So.
Oh, terrific. Scott, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, Charity, thank you so much. You're welcome. It's great to be with you again.
Scott Koepke is the founder and chief gardener for SoilMates, a gardening education program from New Pioneer Food Co-op in Iowa City. Coming up in just a moment, our regular Hort guests will be here to answer your questions. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It is Horticulture Day today, and time now for you to ask your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And Laura Jesse of the Iowa State Plant Diagnostic Lab. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
Thank you for coming back to the show. And, you know, I spent yesterday, a lot of yesterday, in the agriculture building at the Iowa State Fair with Iowa Public Television yesterday, and looking at all of the fruits and vegetables. And, you know, Richard, it turned out to be a pretty good year for tomatoes.
Good.
It was a little bit surprising.
Because I was a little concerned there.
Yeah. But it seems like maybe the dry conditions actually kept a few of the diseases away, maybe.
Right. It may have done that, but I think the stress from the heat and the dryness, if you didn't water, would have been a huge problem, I think.
Yeah, so, I can't imagine you would have had any crop at all if you didn't water this year. And the fruit crops, there were not nearly as many entries this year. What was there looked great, of course, but the tables that are normally laden down with apples were pretty sparsely covered.
Yeah, the freezing temperatures around April 10th, 11th, basically destroyed most of the flowers. So, yeah, not a good year for the fruit crops.
No, not at all. Are you going to be at the fair this year?
Tomorrow.
All right.
I'm judging.
Fabulous.
So,
what are you going to be judging?
Vegetables.
All right. Well, you'll see a lot of happy tomatoes.
Okay, good.
All right. Let's get to our questions. This is from Joan in Kossuth County. She says, our tomatoes look healthy, no sign of blight or pests. They're upright in cages. The Romas have fruit not ripening. The Champions and Early Girls are setting on hardly any fruit and have few blossoms. We've deep watered them every 7 to 10 days. We plant them in a different part of the garden each year, and they're in full sun. Can you shed any light on this problem? Now, this, of course,
yeah,
disproves what I just said, but...
Well, the main problem there was the temperature. When you have temperatures in the upper 90s, 100 degrees or so, those high temperatures interfere with pollination. So even though the plant may bloom, you don't get adequate pollination. So those flowers will simply fall off. It also tends to inhibit flower development, too. So you have fewer flowers on the plant. So that was the main problem.
All right. And this is from Miriam in Clive. She says, this is the worst year in my garden ever. If this heat and drought is the new normal, how do I prepare my garden to survive? Are there species from more arid areas we should be considering in our Iowa gardens?
Well, this is Iowa, and the weather changes typically from year to year. Nothing is the same. So I don't know that what we have this year pertains for next year. It could be just the opposite. But as far as plants, there are plants that are definitely drought tolerant. A number of plants like, for example, butterfly weed, artemisia or wormwood, some of the irises, coneflowers. So there are a number of plants that are definitely drought tolerant. On the other hand, you have plants that need a consistent supply of moisture throughout the growing season. Things like astilbe, ligularia. If they don't get water about once a week, they go downhill very quickly. So you do have that option of selecting plants that are more drought tolerant.
And although I'm not a climatologist, the fact that this is the hottest, driest summer we've had in 60 years probably means that we're not in line for necessarily having many summers like this in the future.
Yeah, it's just hard to say because just a few years ago we had all this rain and we had 3 or 4 years of above normal rainfall. So Iowa weather is very erratic.
All right. Avi is on the line from Fairfield at 866-780-9100, and we do have room for your calls. Hello, Avi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a persimmon tree. It's about 6 or 7 years old. I've grafted one trunk, and its leaves are big and green, and it's pretty drought tolerant. The rootstock, the other trunk, the leaves are much, much smaller, and they have rusty, curled edges, and I was wondering if you knew what was going on.
What is going on the grafted portion of the rootstock?
On the ungrafted portion, really.
Okay. I'm not sure on that. You're not seeing it on the grafted above portion?
Correct.
Okay.
Those leaves are big and green and healthy, and the other ones are smaller and have, yeah, rusty curled edges.
Okay. Well, you could send a sample to the plant diagnostic clinic where you go out and clip off 2 or 3 small twigs or branches, put them in a plastic bag, bring those to the county extension office, and have them send that to the plant diagnostic clinic here at Iowa State.
Mm-hmm. Or you could send some digital pictures, really help with overall plant, and you can send those to sickplant@iastate.edu, some pictures of the whole bush.
Awesome.
All right,
well,
Avi.
I'll do that.
Thanks a lot for your call. And Laura, I was just saying with the very dry conditions, maybe we haven't seen some of the diseases that we normally see. What are some of the things you have been seeing a lot of this summer at the diagnostic lab?
Yeah, it certainly has kind of, we started early with the early spring, but the dry conditions kind of have helped keep some of the disease issues down. I mean, we're still getting a lot of the conifers, but right now we're seeing a lot of just sun-scald heat damage on conifers. We're getting kind of bur oak blight and oak wilt and kind of some of those usual diseases in, and not as much spider mite as we'd imagine, but the field crops, of course, coming in with different problems.
You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We've got a number of lines open right now for your call. They will fill up, so call soon. Dave is on the line from Cedar Falls. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
It has to do with rotenone. It's an insecticide we've used for many years, and now we can't find it, and the bugs are killing our squash and cucumbers. Just wondered if anybody knows about rotenone.
I think it's still out there, but it's very, very hard to find.
Why is it? It's an organic substance.
You have some alternatives as far as organic materials. You can use neem, which is out there. And that is derived from the neem tree, so that's one option.
Oh, okay.
Is pyganic and spinosad available for homeowners? I'm not sure the... I think spinosad is, but I'm not sure the brand name.
Uh-huh. Everyone has seven, but it says on there that it's harmful to honeybees. I can't use something like that.
Well, You have things like seven and eight. Now, as far as the honeybees are concerned, if you have to spray something... it would be best to do it late in the evening when the honeybees are not active. That would be the best time to do that. Not during midday when they're very, very active. So you can kind of get around that a little bit.
Okay. This was a dust that I noticed, though, so it's going to stay on.
Right. Yeah. Oftentimes when you're trying to control insects, liquids are typically more effective than a dust.
Really?
Because they're kind of hard to apply. It's hard to get thorough coverage, so oftentimes a liquid is more effective.
Especially
I've used something, an organic substance. I can't even think of the name of it now, but they kind of like it. I mean, these bugs are kind of gray and flat.
Yeah, it sounds like squash bugs. So the key, like Richard said, liquids, because you can get those underneath the leaves, and that's really the key, is to get the coverage under the leaves where the insects are.
Sure, and I've done that, but it doesn't seem to affect them.
Squash bugs can shake off a lot.
And I think the key there with the squash bugs is getting them when they're small, when they're quite small, because when they get full grown, the insecticides are not very effective. They're almost impossible to kill when they're mature. So the key there is to get them when they're small so they don't have a chance to mature and then produce additional offspring.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much for that information.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Dave.
Bye.
You can join us at 866-780-9100. Ellen is on the line next from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Ellen.
Good morning. I have two questions. I have a hydrangea bush that's several years old. I'm wanting to know, first of all, when is the right time of year to prune it, given normal conditions, and how severely can I prune it? And I have the same question for my honeysuckle bush.
Okay. With honeysuckle, that's easy. They're very tough, resilient plants, and I would prune them probably in March, early April before they leaf out. Now, with the hydrangea, which type is it, do you know?
No, I honestly don't. You know, it has white blooms that turn green and then sort of purple in the fall.
Okay.
Does that help you?
How big a plant is it? How big does it grow?
It's taller than I am, and I'm about 5 feet, and I prune it every year, but, you know, it's got some pretty thick stalks on it now.
Okay, so that probably is a panicle hydrangea, and they bloom on new growth, and they develop into a fairly big shrub that may be 6, 7, 8 foot tall.
Okay.
And so I would prune those in the spring, probably March, early April.
Okay, and how severely can I prune that?
You could prune it fairly severely. I'd prune it maybe as much as a third, where you can take off like a third of it.
Okay, and then I could take like a third of some of the bigger woody stalks out?
Or not. What you can do is you can prune out smaller branches or the entire branch.
Okay.
So kind of prune them at logical points.
Right.
For example, maybe a side branch back to the main branch.
Okay.
If it's a really big branch, maybe the entire branch back to the ground.
All right.
So kind of logical places.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks
You're welcome.
A lot for your call, Ellen.
All right. Have a good day.
You too. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. 866-780-9100. And Stanley is on the line next from Fayette. Hi, Stanley.
Yes, I had a question about cherry tomato plants. Ours are doing wonderful. They're 6 foot tall, bearing a lot of fruit. Do they have to be trimmed back any to help the fruit that's coming?
Nope, not at all. You don't have to prune them. You may have to maybe stake them or put them in a cage. Now, the cherry tomatoes are doing much better than the standard tomatoes because they're more heat resistant. It doesn't affect them as much. So they're typically doing quite well this year, despite the heat.
Yeah, we have two fence posts and each one in large cages. Okay. So doing great. All right, thanks.
Okay.
All right, Stanley, thanks so much for your call. And you can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also leave questions on our Facebook page as well, Iowa Public Radio. With me, Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension and Laura Jesse of the Iowa State Plant Diagnostic Laboratory. And Richard, when you judge vegetables at the Iowa State Fair, when someone like myself looks mm-hmm. at a table full of different kinds of vegetables that all look amazing, how do you pick a winner? What are you looking for?
We're looking for uniformity. They may request a certain number of like tomatoes or peppers, and they should be uniform in size. If you have one that's really big, one that's really small, and some in between, that's not very uniform. We also look for things like blemishes. You don't want something that has a blemish. So it should be uniform in size and color. It should be typical for that variety. And there shouldn't be any damage or blemish on the actual fruit.
All right, so it's not enough to have like one that looks just
right.
Perfect.
Having a huge one doesn't impress the judges, right? They should be uniform.
Do you get to taste things?
No, no.
The way the rest of us judge vegetables is, of course,
right.
by what they taste like, and you just have to imagine.
We have to look at them, and we turn them over, making sure all the sides are perfectly clean and not damaged, and so we look at them.
Yesterday, I saw a lot of the judges weighing things. Do you ever have to weigh any of the vegetables you judge?
No. We're not doing it on size. It's basically... do they look exactly like they should, and are they very uniform? So,
all right. Kevin is on the line next from Iowa City. Hello, Kevin. Hi, Kevin.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your question?
Wondering when the best time was to trim grapevines, if they could be trimmed while they're in the middle of making the grapes, or
yeah.
at what stage is best?
You basically want to prune those in late winter. So that would be like March, early April, before they begin to leaf out. You could do it as early as late February, but basically late winter, early spring.
And what's the best way? One main vine kind of, or how?
It depends upon. Normally, you have some type of support system, and the typical
right.
four-niffin cane system has two wires. And if you do that, you train those vines to those two wires. So it's kind of based on the wires. And the key there as far as pruning them is that they bear fruit on only the previous year's growth, not older growth. But they tend to
okay.
produce way, way too many fruit clusters or buds. And so you have to prune out much of the previous year's growth so they don't overproduce. And so that's the key.
All right. Thank
you. How do your grapes look this year, Kevin?
Not as good as they did when I first had them, I guess. But they're good. They're ripe already, and they've all been eaten already, so they were good.
All right. Kevin, thanks a lot for your call. Cheryl is on the line next from Clinton at 866-780-9100. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What's your question?
My question has to do with acorn squash. My acorn squash seems to be very prolific this year, and I was wondering about harvesting that squash. Should I be harvesting them as they grow the large size, or do I need to wait until fall?
Well, you want to make sure they're mature, because if they're not mature, they won't keep very well. And so what you look for...
How do you tell that?
Well, what you look for, there's a couple things. Typically, the typical acorn squash is dark green, but the side resting on the ground turns a bright orange when it's mature. The other thing is, when it's fully mature, that skin becomes very, very hard. And if you take your thumbnail and try to puncture that skin, you simply can't do it. It's too hard. So those two things.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, Cheryl, thanks a lot for your call. And we have an email question. This is from Tina. I have a really old oak tree that is touching my neighbor's house. I don't want to cause damage to their home, but I also don't want to risk losing the tree. Is it safe to do any trimming before winter?
Well, ideally, you'd wait till basically winter, December, January, February. You probably could do it in late November. The main concern there is the spread of oak wilt. And if you prune during the growing season, there is that risk that the insect may transmit the disease to that pruning cut. So we like to avoid pruning during the growing season.
Okay, so she really needs to wait. Yeah. Laura?
If they can.
Yeah, and if you do have to prune, if there's, you know, storm damage or things like that, you want to immediately paint over that wound with just any outdoor paint will do. You don't need any special tree, you know, cover. Just use outdoor paint and paint over that wound immediately after you make the cut.
All right. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Laura Jesse of the Iowa State University Plant Diagnostic Laboratory and horticulturist Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension. They're both here to answer your questions. Again, the number is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension, and Laura Jesse of the Iowa State Plant Diagnostic Laboratory. They're here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Emma is on the line next from Iowa City. Hi, Emma.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your question?
I was hoping you could identify this weed I've been seeing growing in my garden, and it's done quite well even with the drought. It has a thick red stalk, and it produces little dark black berries. I've been chopping them down, but small ones seem to keep growing up.
And how big is the plant itself?
Well, they range from all sizes. I found one that was about 8 feet tall. It's
okay.
A long stalk, and then some other ones are maybe about 4 feet or even smaller than that. So all shapes and sizes.
And how are they produced, the berries? How are they produced on the plant? Are they single berries? Are they produced on a stalk?
I think they come off the stalk. It almost looks like grapes, and they're dark berries. And I think it's a weed because we haven't planted them in our garden.
My guess would be poke weed, which is a fairly common weed in Iowa. It's a perennial plant. It can develop into a small shrub by the end of summer, where it might be maybe 8 or 10 foot tall. It has very large leaves. The stalk tends to be kind of purplish in color, reddish purple. And then it has this fruit stalk that has small little berries on it. Initially, they're green, but then they turn to a dark reddish purple. It's a very common weed. It has a deep tap root. It can be difficult to control. Now, the pokeweed, supposedly, when it's small, is edible, where you would pick the actual leaves and cook them. But in general, the plant is regarded as poisonous. So I have never tried the plant as far as eating it. And I would be very cautious on that. But typically it's regarded as poisonous. And my guess is it's pokeweed.
All right. Well, thank you. I don't think I'll be eating it.
Okay. I wouldn't either.
All right, Emma. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Jerry on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I just have a couple of quick questions, and thank you for taking my call. I live on a property with some very large old trees, oak. I'm assuming they all are. I just wonder how I can help them out through this drought. It's a little late to ask, I guess, but there's no way I can get around to water them all and give them enough. What can I do to help them? My second question is, when and can I plant or transplant some coneflowers and black-eyed Susans and phlox to a different area in my garden? Thank you very much.
As far as the oaks, if they're well established, they have an extensive root system. It should be huge. And even though it's been stressful, I'm guessing they're coping pretty well, and I wouldn't worry about them. I basically worry about recently planted trees, trees planted in the last 4 or 5 years, because they don't have a very extensive root system, and I would definitely be watering them. But the older trees, I think they're okay. As far as transplanting those things like the phlox, I would probably do that in early spring, just as new growth begins to appear on the plants.
All right, Jerry, thanks for your call. Mark in Urbandale is next. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I have Roma tomatoes, and I have a lot of them, which is a good thing, but on the bottoms of the actual fruit is starting to be a dark spot, and then the whole fruit rots from the bottom going up and ruins each one of them.
Correct. That's very common this year, blossom end rot. It's actually not a pathogen per se. It's due to a lack of calcium. And the culprit there is usually uneven moisture supplies. So the key there is when we're having dry weather to water those plants thoroughly, maybe every 6-7 days, so the moisture supply is fairly even. When you have periods when you have very dry soils and then you water or it rains, and then it gets dry again, then you have uneven moisture supplies, and the plants have difficulty absorbing enough calcium. There's typically enough calcium in the ground. That's not the problem. They just don't absorb it when you have these uneven moisture levels.
Okay, I've got another question off of that then, because I have cans around each one of mine, and they're half buried into the ground. So Are they maybe not getting enough the calcium from the actual dirt in the rest of the garden?
Oh, I think they are, but when you water those plants, don't just add water to the can, because the root system goes well beyond the can. So
okay.
Go ahead and really water the entire area around that plant. So when you water something like a tomato, you want to water it slowly and deeply. And the water should go down at least 6, 7, 8 inches into the soil. And put it in a fairly large area around the plant.
Okay. Well, because my cans are actually, they're 5-gallon buckets with the bottom cut off.
Okay.
So that way I'm also not wasting water over bare dirt. And I can water. I've been actually watering every day.
Okay. That seems excessive. You shouldn't have to be doing that. If you really water well, even during the extreme heat of last week and before, I would think if you did it maybe at least every 3 or 4 days would be adequate.
All right, Mark, thanks a lot for your call. Good luck with that. And next up, let's go to Joseph in Iowa City. Hi, Joseph.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question. I recently moved into a house with a couple of crabapple trees, and they seem to be distressed as of about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and the leaves were turning colors already and dropping off. And I started to water them the other day, and in looking at the leaves a little bit closer, they don't seem to have too many holes in them. They're more dark spots on the leaves. And just wondering if you think those are beetles that are affecting those leaves, or if it's the lack of water, or something that I can be doing to help those out.
It sounds like apple scab is the problem here, which is a really common disease on crabapple, which can cause pretty early defoliation, and some varieties, and Richard will know which varieties are more resistant or not. But it sounds like if you don't have a resistant variety, although it wasn't terribly a big problem this year, the trees will get it. It's pretty harmless. I mean, the trees seem to leaf out each year. It just usually causes early defoliation.
Right.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I'm guessing maybe you have some apple scab and maybe some drought stress combined, So you're getting some leaf drop. But if you're buying a crab apple, make sure the variety is scab resistant, because some of the older varieties like Hopa are very, very susceptible to it. Spring Snow, which is a very popular variety, it doesn't produce fruit, but it's also very susceptible to apple scab.
All right, Joseph, thanks a lot for your call. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Alice is on the line next from Eldora. Hello, Alice.
Hello. I have many oaks who have that have died over the last 10 years since I moved to my house, and I've cut down many of them, and they aren't all connected root-wise, I don't think, but they continue to die off. What would be a good replacement tree for those?
Well, as far as replacement trees, I would look at possibly a maple, like a sugar maple or a black maple.
Okay.
I would look at lindens, like the American or little leaf linden. I would look at possibly a hackberry, possibly a honey locust, possibly a American elm, if you have a elm disease-resistant variety.
Okay.
So those would be possibilities.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for your call. And next up, let's go to Cindy on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What's your question?
Yeah, I have a well-established peony bed, about 10 plants. They've always done great. I'm getting a mildew on them, and the leaves are turning, they're getting browned with spots. And I'm wondering if I should cut those back. Is there anything, way to help them? I have other peonies out in the yard that don't have it, and I don't want it to spread to those.
Yeah, there's some mildews. I think the big thing will be is when you, you know, cut them back later is to remove all the leaf tissue and get it out of the garden. Is that's the big thing. Normally, it, those sort of things are not severe enough to affect the health of the plant. But
so as
so just let it go.
As long as the leaves are still alive somewhat, as long as they're functioning, I'd probably leave it. If they're completely dead, you can cut them off. But as long as they have some foliage that's still green, I would retain that probably into September. And then at that point, I'd cut them off at the ground, remove that plant debris from the garden, and destroy it.
Okay, okay. I get the same mildew in my kale and collards, usually on the wetter years. This year, they're doing pretty good. I mean, it looks very similar. But I don't know. I was kind of shocked that on a dry year, I was getting mildew up here. But anyway.
Yeah, I'm seeing powdery mildew around on plants that are sensitive to it, and there's a lot of different species, and whatever was on, like, the kale and collards is different than what's on the peony, so they tend to be a very specific fungus for each plant, although they all look very similar.
And powdery mildew does not require a wet leaf surface. You can have powdery mildew without constant rain, so...
Well, isn't that nice?
Right.
All right, Cindy, thank you so much for your call. We have time for a few more calls this hour. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Leah sent us this email. She says, I have a young pagoda dogwood that has never properly thrived. I finally pruned off some dead branches and found some kind of little worm or weevil inside many of them. Any ideas?
Well, I think the key there is giving it a good site. The pagoda dogwood likes a moist, well-drained soil and kind of a cool environment. So you typically want to put it in partial shade, preferably morning sun, afternoon shade. If you put those in an open exposed site where it gets very, very hot, like a southern or western exposure, that is stressful. And then when you have a stressed plant, it seems to attract things like cankers and insects. And so if you have a good site for the plant, typically they do fine. But if you don't, you run into problems.
All right. Next up, Cheryl is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Cheryl.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
We have an ash tree in our backyard. It's about 5 years old. It's very healthy, but we got struck with the winds and one of the branches completely ripped off. And I'm wondering, should I put something on this tree wound before winter? Or there's no bugs attacking it or anything, but
right.
I just didn't know for sure what to do.
Yeah, you really can't do much of anything. It used to be a very common practice to put on a pruning paint or a wound dressing.
Mm-hmm.
And the belief was that it would help the tree heal the wound and keep away insects and things like that. But in reality, it doesn't really do that. So our recommendation is just to leave it.
Okay.
Not to paint it, just leave it as it is. Now, if you had like a stump You would cut that off back to the trunk, but if it's basically kind of a clean break, just leave it.
Okay. Thank you so much. I love your show.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. Thanks for the compliment, too. Next up, Butch is on the line in Waukee. Hi, Butch.
Hi. I've got two or three trees on my property. They're at least 25 years old, but they just seem to have sections of dead spots in them. And it's like they're grouped together, so I don't know if it's root damage or what, but I'm wondering if I should cut all those dead spots down or leave them, or what's the best way to handle that?
Well, I guess I would be inclined to prune them out if I felt they were definitely dead. And what you could do is, if you have a branch that has brown leaves on it, I would take that branch, if you can reach it, and bend it very sharply. And if that branch snaps, it's basically dead. Because that branch has died out, it no longer has moisture in it, and it will snap.
Well, most of these don't have any leaves on them at all. They just, okay. It's like a section of the tree is just died or something.
Yeah, I would guess they're dead, and most likely they are, but I would still take one and bend it very sharply just to confirm that.
Okay.
And then I would go ahead and prune them out.
Great. All right, thank you.
All right, thanks for your call. And next up is Teresa in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Teresa.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I have a soft needle pine tree that was planted in 1959, and this Saturday we received high winds. And what happened was the very top of the tree down 30 feet on the trunk, it took the top of the tree and sheared it off. So now I have this pine tree where the very tip of it is open, raw wood.
Mm-hmm.
What shall I do? What advice can you give me as far as what I need to do on this tree?
Okay, it broke off. How high
It broke off the very, if you go from the very top of the tree and come down 30 feet,
okay.
It sheared it.
Okay. And that is how far above the ground as far as where the break occurred?
Probably 30 feet.
Okay.
30 feet, yeah.
Well, it would be, I guess, ideal if you could have someone make a nice, clean pruning cut.
Okay.
And I would go back to the uppermost branch that's still strong and viable and make
okay.
a nice, clean cut, kind of at an angle, if you
okay.
can.
Okay.
That's about all you can do. Otherwise, if you can't do it, I would just leave it and let
okay.
the tree deal with it. But it would be nice if you had a nice, clean cut, because then you'd have less likelihood of rotting occurring at the very top of the tree.
Yes, I understand that. And if I may just take one more minute of your time.
Very briefly.
I also had a dwarf maple tree that got damaged from the storm, so we took it down to the very stump. If I do not want to have it ground, the stump grounded, is there some kind of product that I can put on that so the wood just kind of disintegrates on its own?
Well, you can put on Roundup to make sure it doesn't resprout, but beyond that, it's going to rot naturally.
All right, Teresa, thank you for your call. Richard Giron, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. And Laura Jesse, thank you for coming back.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Laura Jesse of the Iowa State Plant Diagnostic Laboratory. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Allison Sullivan. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Technical support today from Alyssa Weiss in Ames. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. On Monday, a conversation with Dr. Carol Scott Connor about her book, A Few Small Moments. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.